You are now listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com. We hope you will enjoy the program, and if you do, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. Welcome, listeners, to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. I'm Dave Rudman, and I'll be your host for this episode 3 of Spirits Distilled. As always, you can expect Spirits Distilled to bring you knowledge and diverse perspectives from WSET's experts, as well as from throughout the world of spirits. We've got a lot of information. We've got a lot of fun planned. Let's get right into it. In our main feature for this episode, we'll be discussing the art and science of spirits maturation. We have WSET's Charlie McCarthy, Business Development Manager, Spirits, moderating an international panel of spirits experts, which includes Laura Hemme, the head distiller at Roe & Co. Irish Whiskey at St. James Gate in Dublin. Laura spent time working and researching in several countries and has been involved at all stages of the build phase of this new distillery project, including full commissioning, process design, and optimization. Roe & Co. and Laura commenced production in May 2019. She's been featured in a BBC documentary about the whiskey industry and was recently named one of 16 Global Spirits winners in the 2019 Future 50 Awards, a collaboration between the IWSC and WSET, platforming future industry influencers. Also joining Charlie is Yuchen Zhong. As the co-founder of Yuankun, a leading Chinese Baijiu consulting and education company, Yuchen is committed to promoting Chinese Baijiu culture and education across the world. Currently, he is collaborating with domestic and international professionals to communicate Baijiu in a more international and innovative way. And finally, joining the conversation is Ashok Chukalingam, head of international sales and distilling at Amrit Distilleries in India. Ashok has widely traveled around the world and visited and interacted with numerous distilleries in Scotland and Kentucky. Ashok was voted as the World Whiskey Brand Ambassador of the Year in 2012 and 2016 for raising the awareness of the Indian single malt category. We're in for a tremendous program this episode, and so without further delay, Charlie, take it away.
We're talking about maturation, and I'm very aware that maturation can mean slightly different things for different people. So maybe perhaps keeping it in the same order, Laura, in terms of texture, flavor, aroma, volume, and time, obviously you have a bit more experience outside of the world strictly of Roe & Co. You previously worked with Atom Brands and all that that entails in the UK, and I know that you are very academically learned in this area as well in terms of distilling. What does maturation mean for you? I mean, what does the process mean for you as a whiskey maker?
Well, firstly, I see it as a very architectural process and one that works very much in tandem with what we do in the distillery. Symbiotic. We're taking these flavor blocks from the distillery and using maturation to elaborate on them. That would be speaking from a very, I guess, an artistic perspective, perhaps, but that's what we're doing. So when you talk about flavor and aroma development and textural development, these are all the layers of complexity that we're very much trying to build into our spirit using wood as the ornamentation, the elaboration to lift what we've already built. So I see it as an extension of the distillery process, a really essential extension of that distillery process, but one where we're very much about building flavour further.
Okay, amazing. There's a lot of words that I'm going to dig into there, like architectural, artistic, ornamental. I think it's really interesting to see the different approaches. And if I might jump over to Yuchen, I know within the Baijiu process, you do a different process in terms of the fermentation and distillation process, which we might dig into in a bit more detail later. But just
no problem.
With various different styles, various different aromas of Baijiu, I know that there is inert maturation or maturation in clay or ceramic vessels that is common. A lot of people will think of maturation automatically think of wood. That's very obvious why they do that in a Western tradition. Could you talk us through the sort of things that happen in the years that a distilled baijiu will spend in the ceramic or earthenware vessel and why it spends so long in there?
Okay, I think at first there are many similarities between baijiu maturation and other spirits maturations. They all have the flavor and aroma development. They all have texture changes and volume changes. But there are also notable differences. So first, baijiu use a very vessels, and the flavor and aroma development is largely happening within its existing components. Okay. So there are hardly any outside components added during the maturation process. And the maturation is also based on a different philosophy. For baijiu, I think the meaning or the purpose of maturation is not intended to add more flavors and complexities to the baijiu, but rather to actually remove certain flavors and then balance the rest of them. Because of the different kinds of fermentation and distilling process, baijiu has a very strong and complex flavors and aromas to begin with. So for many baijiu producers, there is no point to add extra flavors and aromas to it. Instead, we already have a very pungent and complexity of baijiu. So we have to use maturations to get rid of the pungency and to balance the rest of the components.
So it's almost like you're looking for a development of harmony within the existing flavor components in the spirit. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Fantastic. And moving over to India, within Amrut, I know that you specialize obviously in whiskey, and you've got a very long tradition as far as New World whiskey, in making whiskey. But you also face certain challenges that maybe people in Ireland and Scotland don't face in terms of your managing the rate of maturation because of the difference in the climate.
With regards to the maturation, the objective remains the same. Mm-hmm. It's a question of how you achieve it. And as you rightly said, the environment under which we operate can be quite challenging. And I think we have learned it in a practical way because there was no previous textbook available on hand to follow. So what it appears to us is basically we have a huge variation, for example, between the daytime temperature and the nighttime temperature during our so-called winter. The lowest recorded that I have seen perhaps is was in January, like 9 degrees Celsius, around about like 4 a.m. in the morning. And then we've gone up to like 26 degrees Celsius during the day with like a lot of sunshine. So what we have noticed is basically the casks basically expand and contrast during the day and night, combined with a low level of humidity because of the fact that we are sitting at an altitude of 3,000 feet above the sea. So if you look at the most of the South Indian cities, Bangalore is having like a very mild weather. It's not extremely hot nor extremely cold either. It's kind of like, you know, in between, I would say average working temperature for us would be about like 27, 28 degrees. That basically definitely affects the way how the spirit matures. We certainly have a lot of advantage over it. And then also a huge disadvantage in terms of the angel share, which can run up to somewhere between 10 to 12% per year.
Per annum, wow.
Yeah.
That's quite heavy. With that increased angel share, Obviously, within the context of WCT Spirits courses, we teach that when a spirit goes into a barrel, you have certain additions, certain things that come from the wood into the spirit, certain things that leave the wood, leave the spirit, and then you've got certain filtrations. You've got addition, you've got subtraction, and reaction between the various different esters in terms of oxidation. Is there a faster extraction rate of tannins and other compounds from the wood in a warm environment?
Right. What we have done is we have compared a 4-year-old single malt matured in our distillery with a 12-year-old Highland Scotch single malt, for example, and then subjected both the whiskies to HPLC and analyze the whole components. What we found is like a majority of the components are almost par with each other, from Elijah tannin to gallic acid, you basically name it. And then when we put people on a blind tasting of both the whiskies without revealing what is what, and they have really, really struggled to say which one is how many years old. And then even they basically struggle to find the region. The only key difference that I would say that's what's happening for us is we don't have ethanol dilution happens in the cask as you see in Scotland or Ireland because of the colder temperature in majority of the year. So for us, because the lowest temperature we have seen is like only 9 degrees, only for a few hours, and then you are back to like 25, 26. So what we have is ethanol concentration. So we lose both alcohol and water molecules out of the cask. And then that means because of the higher angel share of 10 to 12% per year, we create a lot of head space about the liquid inside the barrel. Let's say, for example, you fill a 200-liter bourbon barrel, and then year one, you are down to 180 liters. So that means I have a 20 liters of head space above the liquid for more oxygen to diffuse, and mm-hmm. then the oxidization is also rapid. And it's not about like the angel share alone. So the extraction is rapid, and the oxidization is rapid as well, which basically contributes very positively towards the flavor development. That's why it's always not easy for me to produce a 10-year-old single malt or 12-year-old single malt. However, we did it, but we have to do a lot of circus to do that. But this is what exactly happens when it comes to maturation in our climatic condition.
Okay, so you're kind of, if you're looking for an older spirit, you're going to look to use maybe a third fill barrel, some barrel that has already had a lot of extraction happening, or is there a trade secret in there?
No trade secret. You pretty much like nailed it down. So after for us, like 5 years of maturation is kind of like a sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted to mature anything beyond 5 years, in a first fill bourbon or a virgin oak, you are taking a greater amount of risk. So what we do is we basically recask after 5 years into, as you rightly said, like third fill barrel or even sometimes fourth fill. So where the wood influence is like very minimal. So for me, it's a question of mere oxidization and create like more ester components.
Fascinating. Okay, I think this is going to be really interesting for people listening, because sometimes, you know, certain distillers can be very secretive about their process. So this is lovely. Laura, I'm going to throw to you if I can for a second. And I'm going to ask you, you're starting off on quite a large project. You're in the early days of it. I was lucky enough to be shown around the Roe & Co. Distillery earlier on this year. And it's a beautiful building. It seems quite a large undertaking. It sounds like you're laying down an awful lot of stock. How important is it, and what measures do you go through to select your casks?
Yeah, so quality, of course, is really, really important. And a as lots of distilleries in Ireland, Scotland, worldwide, in the whiskey industry would rely on. We do work principally with ex-bourbon casks from the States and a certain amount of fortified wine casks too, amongst very many cask types that we plan to fill and do work with already. So cask quality is absolutely fundamental to the quality of your finished whiskey in the bottle, obviously. And in terms of how we manage that, a lot of inspection first and foremost. Particularly with bourbon casks from the States, how long have they spent traveling? Are they coming in a fresh state? Have they been looked after? We look at the condition of the staves. We look at the thickness of the staves. We make sure they've been stored correctly. Where have they been stored? There's a whole host of issues to do with cask storage that we would look to first and foremost. And believe me, I turn stuff down, and we turn stuff down as a distillery if it doesn't meet those quality criteria. Obviously, the most important thing fundamentally is, do you know where the casks are coming from? And that's key to our quality management procedure. We work with established suppliers. We want to know where that cask has been, what it's been used to hold, what its lifespan has been, and particularly working with first fill bourbon casks, that's fundamental. We'd only ever buy from our approved and certified and traceable suppliers. But of course, you know, all casks undergo a journey, and it's monitoring that journey to ensure it doesn't impact on the quality of the maturing liquid. So there is a lot of nosing that goes on. There is a lot of visual inspection, and a lot of those methods of managing quality are very hands-on, and they always have been. So I do get very involved with that. In Irish whiskey, we have a very flexible definition in terms of the type of wood that we can use. So we're not tied to using oak, which is a huge amount of fun, but also means a huge amount of research and understanding of different wood types and how those different wood types react to different temperature gradients, climates, methods of storage, the density of the wood, the porosity of the wood, what it takes in terms of liquid. So an awful lot goes into that, and yes, a lot of these processes are very difficult to automate, so it involves turning up and having a look most of the time.
Fair enough. And I suppose being part of the wider Diageo family, there's an awful lot of inbuilt expertise within the group that will kind of assist you in
absolutely
not that you don't have the expertise yourself, but I'd imagine across the 50 odd distilleries that
Absolutely. We've got a fair amount of experience, that's sure to be said, across the organisation. And actually, it's one of the great benefits of being effectively a small startup, but within a much wider global organisation. We can draw on a lot of expertise from a lot of distilleries in many different parts of the world, and not just Scotland. We're lucky enough to have that. So it's great. That's a big benefit.
You notice I refrained from asking you specifically which distilleries you're sourcing your barrels from, because I know that's quite a secretive thing in the world of whiskey. So we won't try to look underneath that rock quite yet. Moving on, I'm aware, Yichan, that in Baijiu, we have the maturation period that happens at the end once the distillation has happened. But there's and this is something we do touch on in level 3 at WSET, that it's actually quite a different process, whereas the European tradition is quite linear. You get your sugary liquid, you ferment it, you distill it, and then you put it in a cask to mature it. In Baijiu, the fermentation and the gelatinization and sometimes the maturation kind of happens
at
the same time in a pit. Would you talk people through that, people who might not be familiar with that?
Okay. Most Chinese baijiu ferments more than 3 months. Mm-hmm. And because we rely on not a single type of yeast, but we rely on a diversity of microbes and yeast mm-hmm. cultures. So we are getting all kinds of different components in the result of the transplant chew.
So in this chew, you're going to have yeast, but you'll also have fungus and various different bacteria.
All kinds of different bacteria, fungus, yeast.
Mm-hmm. Okay, really, really interesting. Within the fermentation pits in Baijiu, they tend to develop their own characters as well over a very, very long time, and each individual pit will take on its own personality and condition. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, because lots of Baijiu making process is essentially open to the environment, and the pit you mentioned, especially the pit lined with mud. Mm-hmm. So each pit will have different kinds of mud, and the microbes living in the mud will be very different from pit to pit, from place to places. So companies take very good care of this mud, this pit. And when certain companies, certain producers will move their facilities, they will get the entire pit mud out and move to the new area to hope to keep the growing environment stable and in the new environment. So it's fair to say that the pit, the environment makes a lot of the final product for final product of Baijiu.
I don't know about you all, but I'm feeling more mature already. We'll get back to the conversation shortly, but right now we've got a feature called Desert Island Drinks, where we answer the drinks world's most famous small talk question. If you were stranded on a desert island and could have only one drink, what would it be? Here at Spirits Distilled, we've put a slight spin on the question and are inquiring of our guests, what is your one sipping spirit, your one mixing spirit, and your one guilty pleasure drink? In this edition of Desert Island Drinks, we pose the question to Billy Abbott, a drinks writer, presenter, educator, and head of training for the Whiskey Exchange. And here's what he had to say.
So, looking at the drinks I'd take to my desert island, there's a little bit of a whiskey focus here. So, first things first, a drink that I would want to drink on its own, a spirit that will happily sit in my glass, Talisker 18. It's a whiskey I tried many years ago, and which recently I picked up a bottle at a charity auction, mainly just because I thought it was going too cheap. Unfortunately, I got the price wrong, and I ended up paying over the odds for it, all for charity. But the whiskey itself was absolutely stunning, and it's my current go-to sipper, and one that I can imagine sitting and drinking for years. Going for something which I can mix. Again, I'm going for whiskey. I would go for Elements of Isla Peat, Full Proof. It's a blended malt whiskey. It's made by friends of mine, so I'm slightly biased. But this style of whiskey, this big, smoky, peaty whiskey that you can add a load of soda water to, make a really long, great, refreshing, fizzy, but still smoky highball. But my guilty pleasure, my spirit that I go back to all the time, my one which I don't really talk about very much, is St. George Pear Brandy. It's incredible stuff, which tastes like biting into a pear. And if I could just drink one thing forever and ever, it'd be this.
Wow, Talisker has a special place in my heart as well, Billy. It was the first drink I ever ordered in a bar. And while I was 18 years old, unfortunately, the whiskey was not. Hopefully, the statute of limitations is up for that infraction. Thanks, Billy. We'll be hearing more from him later in this episode. But let's jump back in with Charlie, Laura, Yuchen, and Ashok as they continue their conversation about spirits maturation.
In India, obviously, Amrit were at the forefront of developing the Indian style of whiskey, which has developed a huge fan base internationally over the last 10 years in particular. You guys, how much were you following the traditions of Scotland, and how much, when it came to maturation, were you saying to yourselves, okay, we've got to do our own thing? Because I know you guys do quite funky stuff with hybrid casks, and you have spirits that are matured both in Scotland and in India. And I know you've got a rum as well. So maybe you could talk us through that process where you had to almost develop your own approach to maturation.
So the hybrid barrel is my idea was to, for example, I want to make a barrel which consists of the staves of like New American oak, New French oak, New Spanish oak, ex Oloroso sherry staves, and then ex Pedro Ximenez sherry staves. So the problem is, when you construct a barrel, you cannot process all these woods in the same way, right? So for example, American oak got to be charred to level 3 to 5 or whatever you want to. French, you cannot char in the same way as American. Otherwise, it's going to throw out a lot of tannins. So it has to be toasted. Spanish is even worse. So it has to be like, it has an even higher amount of tannin. So it has to be like very mildly toasted. And then PX staves and Oloroso, you can't process them because it's already basically seasoned. All I need to do is basically have to incorporate. And then the thickness of PX and Oloroso is like this thick. And then American is this thick. And French and Spanish, you can perhaps bring it to the same level. So the question is, how do you make a barrel to bring all the staves together? So then after like a half a day of brainstorming, so what we have done is we have made a new American oak barrel with the charred 3. And then we made a new French oak with the toasting. We made a new Spanish oak with the even light toast. And then PX and Oloroso staves were cut into a barrel size and then assembled a barrel of PX and Oloroso.
Wow.
Then we have dismantled all of them. Then we put one stave after the other from all the 5 different barrels and then built a 6th barrel, which consists of all the woods processed at the way it should be. For example, it toasted, charred, lightly toasted, and then only cut. And then on the one side, I put a new American oak barrel head with the charring. And the other side, I put a French oak barrel head with a light toast.
Wow.
And, okay, so this is how the barrel was made. Now, if you look at that, I haven't broken any rules of SWA. I have all used oak wood. There is no oak cross or anything. I did not put any piece of wood inside, nothing. The whole barrel was constructed within the framework of what SWA has put in, and that's like was a smashing factor. So, well, you came up with the barrel, which is like very novel, which was not done before. Now, obviously, the question is how the product is. So, the first 1 year, 2 years, I was not hopeful at all. It was not heading in the right direction. But year 3, it completely changed its perspective. And year 4, it was like mind-boggling. And so we matured our New Mex spirit in an ex-bourbon barrel for the first 3 years and then moved into what I call the Spectrum barrel. And then matured there for about like 3.5 years, total 6.5 years in Indian climate, in Bangalore climate is a donkey age. So, and that's how the Amrut Spectrum was produced. I just basically came up with this idea mainly because of the time that I spent on the market. For example, the inspiration for me on this one came from Compass Box Oak Cross. For example, they had like a lot of controversy on the Oak Cross when they first created. Then I basically gone through the detail of what they have done differently so that SWA came heavily on them. So it's basically, these were the learning curves for me. And then I just basically expanded that idea to further, not just with like 2 different kinds of oak, but 5. So that's how we expanded.
In terms of innovation versus tradition, obviously with you guys at Amrut, you guys have kind of treaded that really interesting line where you're following the SWA regulations largely, but you're making your own style. I want to maybe open this up to the floor, maybe asking Yuchen possibly if there is room within various different aroma styles of baijiu for innovation at the moment. Could you potentially use wood, or is the regulation very, very much set in stone? And maybe then over to Laura talking about the various styles of wood that you can play around with in Ireland that you maybe can't play around with in other countries. So I'm going to leave that open to you guys. Whoever wants to jump in, go for it.
I think it's highly possible for Baijiu to experiment in wood, because traditionally, like we said, there are ceramic pottery for Baijiu. There are also people are using also another different kind of container, which is as old as ceramic pottery. It's called Zhuhai. It's like wattles or twigs, and people use wattles or twigs to make a huge basket, and then mix quicklime and pig blood to a kind of moldable protein colloidal salt to seal the basket completely.
Is that like Phoenix aroma, or am I confusing?
Phoenix aroma, yes.
Yes, okay.
And yeah, this kind of containers could be huge, and capacity ranging from 5 tons to 25 tons, and it could also impact the flavor of Baijiu directly. So it's very unlike the ceramic pottery. And people are also experimenting in all kinds of ways to impact Baijiu aging, like conducting oxygen directly to Baijiu, use ultraviolet light treatment, supersonic wave, high energy beam, laser beam, microwave, all kinds of different ways. And like you said, there are people experimenting to put Baijiu in wooden barrels to see what happens. But the result is complex. Like for stronger aroma Baijiu, like strong aroma and sauce aroma Baijiu, the result is more of a disappointment. Like strong Baijiu flavors and wooden flavors do not merge peacefully together. It's more like a parallel flavors.
They fight against each other.
Yes, but like, but when we talk about Baijiu, we're not talking about one type of spirits. There are at least 12 different types of Baijiu. So there is huge potential for lighter Baijiu styles, like light aroma Baijiu and rice aroma Baijiu, which themselves have very little flavors to begin with. So it's very big potentials to experiment in barrels.
Okay, well, maybe you got two distillers here who have lots of barrels in their distilleries. Maybe you might want to start.
Yes, we can send some samples.
No, that's how these things happen. Laura, thank you, Chen. Laura, hopping over to you. I know you touched on it very briefly that within Ireland there's a less regulation on the type of wood that can be used. I know this could be within the context of Diageo. It could also potentially be in the context of Atom, because as part of that boutique whiskey, I was very honoured to have my face on one of those bottles. It was a lifetime goal of mine to appear on a bottle of whiskey. That was made possible, so it was wonderful. But yeah, what's your kind of experience or takes on the really experimental side of stuff?
Yeah, so tons of fun. Yeah, we, as you say, we are not tied to using oak in Ireland. We can experiment with a huge range of wood that can be used for cooperage purposes. I was super excited about that because I'm a massive fan of chestnut in any kind of wine maturation, even very, very old sherries and certainly in whiskey. So, we have a huge variety of different types of wood that we can use, and not all of them work. We have lots of ambitions to lay down a very wide range of different styles of wood. And a lot of that will be to play and just experiment, which is what a good inventory should be about. But I think in whiskey terms, there are specifics that we're looking for. And when we talk about innovation, all innovations have a root in some form of tradition. So the wood has to work with making a barrel, for example, and it has to have a certain amount of play that can be, it has to be able to hold water, has to be able to hold liquid. That there are certain qualities that you're definitely looking for in terms of how that wood behaves in a warehouse and with your liquid in it. But it's also, it has to have a bit of integrity, I think, and it's not a case of us just throwing anything in any type of wood. There has to be some kind of integrity behind innovation, and I think it's really important because we're not, in the Irish whiskey industry, we're not a new disruptive whiskey category that's appeared out of the last 5 years. This is a whiskey category that has a huge amount of history. Whiskey has been made on this island for centuries. And yeah, I think tradition, innovation are very interchangeable words. And I think I heard Irish distillers say something kind of really nice about this recently, that all tradition had been an innovation once. And that's a very cool thing to say. And it's very true. Likewise, all innovation has come from that. So I think that we have to maintain standards. We have to ask ourselves as distillers, would we drink it? Is that going to be adding to the category? Is that going to be doing something positive for the category? On the one hand, the other part of me, which is the naughtier part of me, wants to just take everything apart and look at everything in complete minutiae detail, start from scratch and think, what actually is a cask? What does it do? What can we do to actually improve every little element of this to deliver something delicious? Because that's ultimately what we do as distillers, as people working with wood. We want to create something fantastic. And my gut wants to take every part of that to pieces and work out what I can do to make it better. And I think we have lots of really interesting questions ahead of us as a whiskey industry globally, in terms of how we manage questions like sustainability, maturation length, what we do to impact flavour with less time, with more time. Yeah, maturation is a massive part of that. Innovation is a massive part of that. Without giving too much away, I think everything should be on the table.
Fantastic, folks. What I'm hoping from this is that everybody who's listening to it will get a really good idea of the different methods and traditions of maturation and practices of maturation from around the world. And you never know. Hopefully, you guys might talk to each other. We might start a barrel exchange program, or maybe a clay pot exchange program between various different distilleries, and we might end up with something very innovative a few years down the road. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Uche. And thank you, Ashok. It's been an absolute education for me. It's been a pleasure listening to you. I'm very much looking forward to continuing the conversations and to enjoying the spirits that we've been talking about, and continuing talking about them with WSET. Thank you all very much for your time. It's been a pleasure for me.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. Good to see you, Laura and Yuchen. We'll be in touch as a technical professional, always, you know.
Definitely, definitely. Great to hear you. Yeah, super exciting.
Everything is on the table. I'll keep that in mind, Laura, as we look forward to seeing the innovation coming our way from you and from all the world's spirits producers. Very exciting stuff. That's all for our main feature for this episode on spirits maturation. Thanks so much to Charlie McCarthy, Laura Hemi, Yuchen Zhong, and Ashok Chokalingam for their time and their expertise. Before we go, we've got one more feature that we like to do. It's called Letter to My Younger Self, where we ask some of the spirits world's most experienced and successful players to let us know what advice they would give themselves when they were first getting started on their journey. In this edition, we're back with our friend Billy Abbott, head of training for the Whiskey Exchange, to hear his advice to his younger self.
Dear Billy, here are a few things you might like to know. First things first, you made the right choice. This whole bidding the wonderful world of computers and everything like that and going to work in the drinks business? Correct. That was the right thing to do. You'll work longer hours, you'll work a lot harder, you'll be a lot more tired, but you'll have a lot more fun. So much cool stuff. Good work with the decision making and stuff like that. We chose right. But don't just stick with whiskey. Whiskey's your thing. I know whiskey's your thing. But look beyond the world of whiskey. Drink everything in moderation, obviously, but drink all the things. Try all the things. Learn about all the things. Mezcal and tequila, it's not going to be their year. Every year is their year. Every year is not their year. So don't get so hung up on that as I did. Don't do that. Gin, it'll be big. It'll be huge. But don't get caught up in that either. You know, it's not that interesting, really. You know, there's loads of gin out there, and I recommend you just drink Negronis like I did. Oh, Negronis. They're a thing now. We all drink Negronis. So, Negronis. on the whiskey front, Japanese whiskey. Load up on Japanese whiskey, load up on the knowledge, buy the stuff, drink the stuff, learn all about it. It's incredible world of whiskey that, you know, we didn't even know was there. It's exploded. It's huge. So much great stuff to try. So many great things to seek out. So many great things to buy for an investment and then sell in the future and buy yourself a new house. But most of all, most importantly, when it comes to the world of Japanese whiskey, buy lots of Ibiki 17 and drink it. Other than that, well done. You have a wonderful, interesting, slightly scary ride ahead of you. But as long as you have enough Ibiki 17, you'll get through.
That was great, Billy. Great advice. Thank you so much for sharing it here with us at Spirits Distilled. And that's all for episode 3 of Spirits Distilled. I hope you enjoyed the program. We hope you'll join us again next time for another fantastic episode. Until then, I'm Dave Rudman saying cheers from WSET. Thanks for listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Please remember that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WSET. If you enjoyed this program, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com.